Pinging some people into the room. Welcome, everyone. This is a clubhouse with our senior scholar, Richard Salzman. He's a professor of political economy at Duke. This is going to be an Ask Me Anything about objectivism. But if you have other questions about economics or what have you, then feel free to raise your hand and we will get you up on stage so we can have a great conversation. I'd also like to ask everyone who's here to please share the room, share it using that share button on Clubhouse and your other social media platforms. So excellent. So we'd love to get audience questions. If not, we've got about 65,000 followers on Instagram, many of whom have asked questions on relating to objectivism. So Richard, maybe I can just pick from one of those if you're ready to go.
Sure. Let's go.
All right. Okay. Well, one question that has come up is what would be objectivism's stance on the Second Amendment and the right of self-defense?
Well, self-defense is part of, you could argue, a rational, egoistic ethic. And so in terms of individual rights to life, liberty, property, the pursuit of happiness, this is a means of defending your life. Now, I don't want to be just defensive about it. I mean, it also encompasses things like hunting and fishing and things like that. But also I would expand it beyond what people normally think of, which is defending themselves against common criminals. It's much more controversial to say possibly defending yourself against a criminal government. And I think because Locke and then the founders who loved Locke believed in a right to revolt against governments that violate your rights, it's encompassed there as well. I do think issues of size of weapons, quantity of weapons, magnitude of weapons is something for philosophy of law. And so it's in that regard, a specialty. I'm not sure I would go so far as the president who said recently the Second Amendment is not an absolute right. I mean, when objectivists speak of absolutes, they speak of, no conditions that would dilute the right in any way. But I don't think that's what we're talking about here. The same thing in the First Amendment, there can be conditions associated with things like, other than libel, slander, defamation, things like that. Same thing, I think, with the right to bear arms. But I think it's I wouldn't call it a fundamental right. It's a right that derives from the right to one's life, and therefore the right to defend it. And I would say, by the way, the fact that today you see a dilution of this right, that is very prominent in America today, where more and more you get in trouble by wielding a weapon, not in an aggressive way, but in self-defense, and often you get in trouble for that. And I think it's part and parcel of an overall kind of dilution and attack on anything self-interested. So self-defense, which most Americans think of as a commonsensical right, itself is being eroded. So I hope that helps.
Great. Thanks, Richard. And Stephen, so great to see you here.
Hey there.
Jennifer, Jennifer, can I just add something quickly? Because it's topical. I think the mass shooting, Stephen Hicks has had whole discussions of this in the past, so look for those on Atlas as well. But I believe the mass shootings, the pandemic of those in America in recent decades, is in part due to abrogating the Second Amendment. So gun-free zones laws were passed first in 1995, and mostly by Republicans. If it amounts to a suspension of that right in particular areas, and that would, in my view, invite, and I think gun scholars have shown this, something like 95% of the mass shootings have occurred in gun-free zones. So there's a practical kind of headline example of what happens when the right is suspended, that's effectively suspended in those zones.
Great. Stephen.
All right. Hey there. Just kind of an esoteric question. I just saw this this pop up here, so I thought I would just join in and ask you if it's an ask me anything. I've been a long time objectivist adjacent, and if you remember, Ayn Rand argued that an immortal robot could not have values. Okay, and her argument was that it didn't face the prospect of death, so so nothing it did really mattered, something like that.
Yes.
So, okay, but say, take your typical Christian who's actually sincere. They actually do believe they're immortal, but they seem to have values. So how would you square that?
Oh, that's a very clever question, Stephen. If you're saying, I mean, it sounds a little logic chopping a bit to me, a little rationalistic, but I mean, I think there's no doubt about Ayn Rand's point that values derive from the conditional nature of life. Okay, so let's just stipulate that. Now, moving to the Christian view, they may think they have eternal life and immortal life. It's not true. I think by saying sincere, I think what you're saying is the Christian is saying, since I sincerely believe that, you know, show according to Ayn Rand that I'm not a robot. I think the way they get away with this is they have an intrinsic dogmatic code to live by. You know, it's called the Sermon on the Mount or the Ten Commandments. So, if I get your question correctly, you're asking, well, why would they have values? Why would they, you know, act morally? I think they themselves would say, because someone gave me this preset code of values and virtues to follow.
Right. I guess what I'm really getting at is, yeah. I mean, I understand she's using this as a fantastic example to illustrate her basic point, which I think is sound. But I wonder if it's actually true. And I think what she misses here in her simple example is,
yeah,
it's not that you're immortal, it's that you believe you're immortal. Because if you had an immortal robot who didn't know he was immortal, and so he thought he faced the prospect of death, then he presumably would have values.
Yes.
So it's really not your immortality, it's your knowledge. And like I said, I don't see why a robot couldn't have pre-programmed intrinsic values by his creator or whatever, even if he's immortal, and have values like the Christian could. I guess it comes down more to the fact that, as even Rand would say, we don't value mere survival. We value survival as a man, right? Or according to your nature.
Right,
So even if you're immortal, you still might be living a miserable existence because you're frustrated and the purpose is appropriate to your type of being.
Right.
So,
well, right.
Yeah.
Well,
so anyway.
Yeah. She says not just survive, thrive. That's a good point. And the other thing to remember is, I mean, even a sincere Christian, I think they might say what survives is the soul in some way. Even they would not admit that the body does. So if we have mind-body integration, then it gets back to her point. Yeah, well, that is conditional. And most Christians admit that their physical body goes out of existence. But what they're thinking is eternal and immortal is the soul. So they're bifurcated the minute they die. So this is not the concept Ayn Rand's talking about. She's talking about the fully integrated human. But it's a good question, Stephen. Thank you.
Could I jump in, Richard, for a second?
Sure. Of course, David. On any of these topics, feel free to jump in.
There's another angle on this that might be worth mentioning. In the logic of Ayn Rand's ethics, she says life or death. An ethic depends on facing an ultimate alternative. Well, for secular people, like objectivists, that means life or death, than which there is nothing more fundamental. But for a Christian, a true believer, the fundamental alternative is not life or death in this life. It is salvation or damnation. Hmm. And you can the same logic applies to that. To be saved, you need to follow certain rules and pursue values, faith, you know, faith, hope, and charity. If you don't, you end up in hell. So it's the structure, the logic of her argument is fundamentally sound across any ethical view. It's just that, we also have a metaphysics that says, as you were saying, mind and body go together, life, there's no life after death, no supernatural world, et cetera.
Mm.
David, I just wanted to, hey, David, nice to hear you, by the way. Just to be literal, do you think she was right then? Like, if you actually had a robot who was intelligent and believed he was immortal, do you think he really could not have values? Like, not that it matters too much, but do you think that's actually accurate?
Well, it's kind of ambiguous because mortality means two things. It means you can die and that you will die. So that is, you have a finite lifespan, so you're going to die. But along the way, you can die. Now, if the robot is indestructible, then I don't think anything can matter to it. But it's kind of a fanciful example anyway. I'm not sure this was the best example for her to use because robots, they don't have consciousness. They only have the goals that are programmed into them. So we come back to human beings in the end.
The other thing I've noticed on this topic is a more common objection to her example, her the approach is, well, you don't, it's not life or death in the sense of you tip over tomorrow if you're a drunkard. You know, it takes time, takes a long time. You can live a long time, you know, in a vice-ridden life. True enough, but that's the nature of human life as well. It has this longevity to it. And yes, you don't immediately expire due to one vice, unless it's a really bad one, murder or something. Anyway, thanks, Stephen. Thanks, David.
Robert, welcome. Do you have a question for
Yes. I'd like to ask Richard his assessment of a certain proposition while keeping in mind something John Galt said. He said, quote, "Your character, your actions, your desires, your emotions are the products of the premises held by your mind." And the proposition that I'd like your opinion of is the following. Using the mind to choose action harmful to yourself is the product of the mind holding the false epistemological premise that man's mind is not his basic means of survival.
The broadness of the way you conceived of the last one. So repeat that again, using the mind. So a person is choosing destructive path, you're saying, and you're wondering what the premise might be?
Yes.
I would think the premise would be not, I'm destroying myself because I don't think reason is valid. The way you put it, at least, they're using reason to undermine themselves. I mean, the underlying premises would be that you have either disvalues or no values. So I'm thinking of the suicidal person who is not so much terminally ill, but depressed and has psychological problems associated with that. They don't have a value system. They don't have desires or emotions. You know, we think of these very kind of robotic people who come to the end of their tether, so to speak. But, premises also that are malevolent. I'm not a psychologist, but I would also think that the proposition you're talking about would be valid if someone said, my values are not achievable. So malevolence toward whether values are achievable, one, and also whether you're efficacious, even if you had values, if you didn't think you could achieve them, or if you didn't think you were worthy, that's a moral assessment of yourself. I'm unworthy of pursuing these values. And then also you can have malevolence toward other people. I mean, to the extent we live in a society where achievement of your values does require some cooperation with others, a truly, malevolent view, an antagonistic view, a paranoiac view toward others would also would be the kind of premises that would be self-destructive, I would think. David, you want to jump in here? I mean, she did say that these are your character, actions, desires, emotions, yes, the products of your premises. And she was famous for saying, check your premises. But the basic premises that would cause self-destructive behavior or attitude.
Well, I think there are many of them, including the ones you mentioned. There's short-term focus on short-term values, pleasures, versus long-term consequences. there is people who value fame and like Peter Keating, or power like, you know, wine in the Fountainhead. When they have those underlying premises, in that effect, they go wrong and defeat themselves in many. There's so many ways of going wrong that it, again, I'm not a psychologist either, so I wouldn't dream of trying to catalog them. But I think that usually there's some substantive premise that, I mean, this is what psychologists are for, therapists anyway, is to uncover it. What are the premises that are leading you to self-destructive behavior? So it's in some cases, I think it, like as Robert was saying, it can be distrust of your own reason, or failing to use reason adequately. Ultimately, that's probably at some level the involved in anything. But
So if this basic means of survival, if this faculty, is either not trust your own faculty, if it's either not trusted, or you don't quite know how to use it, you don't know the laws of logic, or worse, I think today the idea that people think that the mind shouldn't be operative, and so people resort to whatever their feelings are, and well, if I can't persuade others, then I'll resort to violence or the crudity of what we see in social affairs these days. So that would certainly be self-destructive, but it's because of what Robert's saying. It's this abandonment of the faculty, so to speak, or the inability to cultivate it properly. I do think that's relevant too.
Yeah, me too.
Well, among the premises of the people that you're talking about, is one of them the mind is his basic means of survival, or his mind is not his basic means of survival, or is that not included in his premises at all?
I wonder, Dave, I don't know what your view is on this, David, but I wonder actually how many people hold that premise explicitly.
Well, I could mean implicitly or explicitly.
Right. But implicitly and explicitly, but also to the intensity of caring that they really truly use it. Maybe if you ask most people, they would say something. Yeah, I got to use my mind sometimes, but I also go by my feelings, and I'm kind of buffeted by what my friends and others say. So it's apropos, like compared to an objectivist who is so used to hearing this that my mind is crucial. I remember when I first read Ayn Rand, I noticed internally by introspection an elevated view of my mind. She taught me that, hey, this is an important faculty. You need to work on this. You need to cultivate it. You need to exercise it. You need to learn things. And I was a fairly decent person before then. I didn't feel myself like a mindless bodily person running around. So I think the premise itself can make you want to cultivate your mind more once you are convinced of the importance of its efficacy. We put it that way, I think.
Great. I want to get Clark in here.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Robert.
Yes, Richard, thanks for hosting again.
Sure.
I have a couple of economics questions, if I could.
Okay.
The first involves the Fed. A lot of people think we should audit and then end the Fed. And I'm kind of persuaded to that view. In other words, I think just sound money, we could make it without any kind of a governmental national central bank. So I'm curious about that first, your views on the Fed, and basically even if you want to expand on fractional reserve banking, I'd love to hear that too. The second question related, there's a lot of people, as I'm sure you're aware, obviously you're aware, on the libertarian right who seem to believe that loose money, a very low interest rate policy benefits the deep state. And so there's there's some deep state people who are somehow wildly profiting from our basically zero interest rate policy that we've had for for as long as I can remember. I mean, for a long time. But I kind of reject that view because it seems as if, you know, if we have a deep recession, everybody, you know, loses. I mean, maybe some people obviously lose more than others, but you know, so I guess if you could address that too, just the whole idea that the only reason we have loose money is that there's just a few elite, you know, bankers who were raking in, and somehow, you know, somehow I guess they're not going to be, you know, they're not going to lose when the whole thing comes crashing down.
Yeah, good question. I've written on this. I want to dig deeper because I'm going to give a fairly provincial answer here. 1990, I wrote a book called Breaking the Banks, Central Banking Problems and Free Banking Solutions. So it was roughly 30 years ago that I first made the case against central banking. You mentioned the Fed in particular. That's just the U.S. central bank. But there have been long stretches of history without central banks, and economies did quite well. They were on the gold standard on a system called free banking, where the banks themselves issued currency convertible into gold. So also went from 1995, gold and liberty. So if you go to American Institute for Economic Research, you can get those actually online. More recently, at the centenary of the Fed founding in 2013, so it was founded in 1913. In 2013, I wrote a two-part essay called The End of Central Banking. So you might want to look for that. It was the objective standard. And I use the end in two ways. One, the end as in the purpose of central banking. And the second part, the end, is I gave a plan for dismantling the Federal Reserve and going back to the gold standard and free banking. So you might want to look at those. As to your other questions, I have learned over the years that the standard explanation for central banking is wrong. And the standard explanation is markets themselves fail to provide sound money and stable banking. And therefore, it was argued governments have to provide money and regulation of banking, basically because of laissez-faire fails. And that is not what the history shows at all. As I said before, free market systems worked wonderfully in the past. Now, this gets to the issue of then why? If the central banks are not there to preserve sound money and their track record has been bad on that, or safe banking, or other things we hear like fighting inflation or smoothing the business cycle, or being a lender of last resort during crises, the bottom line purpose I have discovered is to finance profligate government. That's it. They've often been started during wars when financing was needed, non-tax-based. So I would succinctly put it as the purpose of central banking is to provide a financing funding mechanism for profligate governments. And by profligate governments, I mean those who spend so much for whatever purpose, they can't possibly tax people enough to support it. And if you know anything about public finance, if government spending exceeds what the tax revenues are, the only alternative is to borrow. So the government borrows, if you still don't have a central bank yet, it borrows, but then if it borrows too much, the central bank is used as the vehicle for buying the government debt. That's called monetization of debt. It's called what we call today QE, quantitative easing. But the policy you mentioned also of bringing interest rates down very, very low, sometimes to zero, sometimes to negative, that's part of the same purpose. Namely, not only do we want to help government finance itself, but as cheaply as possible. So notice none of this has anything to do with the economy, and in many ways undermines the economy by dickering around with interest rates. So just to sum it up, central banking is improper. It's basically central planning applied to money and banking. So it's an instance of central planning, and it's no part of a free market economy. Another thing you might want to look at, because this sounds very idyllic when someone says, well, just dismantle the Fed and what would be left. As an intermediate solution, I have said at Cato Journal, published this a couple of years ago, you could have the central bank on a gold price rule. It's a kind of version of the gold standard that makes the Fed and other central banks behave better than they do now. So it would give them some kind of yardstick or objective measurement. It's not quite the gold standard on free banking, but it's also not central banking doing whatever it wants as it's doing today. So that's called real and pseudo gold price rules. If you want to look it up, that's at the Cato Journal 2020. The fractional reserve banking, I argue in my books, is perfectly legitimate so long as the depositors and everyone knows. And those libertarians and Austrians and Rothbardians and others who say that it's inherently fraudulent is wrong. It's not inherently fraudulent. A fractional reserve banking is simply banking that takes deposits and lends them. And if you don't do that, you just have basically a safe deposit box.
I guess just to clarify then, so it sounds like then we have inflation and loose money and, you know, artificially low interest rates, basically because the American people want something for nothing. And the politicians, I mean, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, of course, but the politicians basically don't have the backbone to say, well, American people, you can't really have something for nothing, but we're going to try to fool you into thinking you can by basically monetizing the debt. And so I guess what I'm getting at is, in some weird way, the recession that we're almost certainly going to have within the next 12 months, in a way, that's something that we've maybe not us in the room here, but the American people, because they don't want to live within their means. At least they don't want the government to. They want the government to keep providing, you know, more money than we're, I guess, sending into Washington. In a way, this inflation rate of whatever, I think it's 8-9%, whatever it's at now, this is kind of the price we're paying. It's kind of like maybe we're, you know, the punch bowl has to be taken away, the proverbial punch bowl, and now, you know, there has to be a hangover. And it basically, it's going to affect all of us, not just some kind of super rich deep state elite.
The essence of what you said, which I totally endorse, is it is the pursuit of something for nothing. Yes. When people demand that the government provide, $5 trillion in spending, but then there's only $3 trillion in taxing, there's a $2 trillion gap. And there's only three ways to finance a government: taxes, borrowing, and money printing. And the last two are not noticeably painful to anybody. And so it isn't surprising that politicians would figure out what is the least painful way we can extract money from the economy without getting thrown out of office or facing a tax revolt. Answer: borrow and print money. Well, and
it's not painful until the recession is. And then,
well, it becomes temporarily not painful, because it takes a while for prices, inflation to pick up and interest rates to rise. Then the real puzzle for most people in the last decade or so was, how could they have printed so much money and issued so many bonds without interest rates going up and inflation going up? Well, of course, both of them are going up now. So you can't con the law of supply and demand. Eventually it come back to hit you. The question I have today is whether people realize that the higher interest rates and higher inflation are due to demanding this government spending that isn't taxed. I don't think that's widely understood. So there's always a danger of blaming the bankers who set interest rates or the business people who set prices and blame them for the inflation and the higher interest rates. But thank you. That's a good question, Clark. Thank you.
Great. I want to also recognize that we have another senior scholar, Professor Stephen Hicks, who's in the room. And actually, we have yet another, Professor Jason Hill, also in the room. So great to see you guys here. And Tom, looks like you're new to Clubhouse, and welcome. Do you have a question for Professor Salzman?
Thank you. And this question is more to David. Hi, David. If I go back to a little bit to what Richard just said, I do remember Riesman said that it's what kind of money that is going to be fractional, whether it is demand deposit versus saving. So that's a crucial item to keep in mind. But now to the question that I have, it is based on yesterday's discussion on open versus closed system. And David, you said that two characteristics for a system is it complete? And the other one is it integrated? And if it is integrated and a closed system, then a change in one of the underlying integrated premises will change the identity of the system. So I wonder if, given our position here of an open system, that perhaps you have identified, I have in mind one, but perhaps you have identified something in objectivism that may cascade and alter a little bit of the system.
Oh, well, that's a, thank you, Tom. That's a highly theoretical question. My argument against the idea that the philosophy of objectivism has to be closed because any change would ripple through the system and affect everything else is, I think, a rationalist idea. I don't think objectivism in particular is anywhere near as brittle as that. Because most of the points are based on induction, individually on induction. This is not a deductive system like Euclidean geometry or other branches of mathematics where you change one of the axioms and everything, you know, everything, all the theorems change. Objectivism is a philosophy that is based on observation and induction, and every point has inductive support, as long with fitting into a system that can be, you know, thought of as systematic. And I don't want to go too much into this. Will Thomas and I wrote have a book online called The Logical Structure of Objectivism. It makes many of these points very clear. But anyway,
that's the reason why I'm asking. It's so rare to have a technical discussion, and that's why I'm looking for this opportunity to get some clarity, and especially in LSO that I'm trying to locate, and perhaps one point that may be something that is different from Ayn Rand's writing, and that is in one of the point that you made about the cardinal values. And that is reason, a purpose, and instead of self-esteem, you said self. So yes. That change of self-esteem to self doesn't that cascade into all the other areas?
I don't think so. I mean, I take your point. We did change that, and it's because self-esteem seemed too narrow for the kind of cardinal value. Ayn Rand said almost nothing about the nature of cardinal values. And what you find in the Logical Structure book is mainly my analysis of what they mean and why they are so fundamental. And so I can't go into all that now, and I don't want to take time away from Richard. But in the case of self-esteem versus self as a cardinal value, self-esteem is a psychological value, hugely important, but underlying it, and I used to argue about this with Nathaniel Brandon, but even he would say the idea of acting for your own life starts with a basic conception of self. You have to be a self before you can achieve self-esteem, and I think that only strengthens the system across a number of counts. For example, it makes more sense of egoism, self-interest, because, you know, ultimately our interest has to do with preserving a self. Well, what is the self? And self-esteem, of course, is hugely important as a psychological asset. But there are many ways in which we can be aware or fail to be aware, can advance or fail to advance our lives as individual selves, that I go beyond the this psychological trait. So I think in this case, your example, I would say this strengthens the system. You know, I say that modestly, but I'll just mention one other thing that might be an example of larger ripples. And I mentioned yesterday, one of the issue that's been not very well developed in objectivism is the ethics of families. And one of the things about families is that they involve involuntary relationships. You don't choose your parents, you don't choose your siblings. And yet, so you can't model all of that, all of those relationships on the model of voluntary friendship. We can try, see how far we can go with that, and we have, but I'm not sure that that's a full answer. So that may have a larger implication on, for example, the principle of the trader principle, that all relationships should be a matter of trade based on voluntary exchange of values. I don't want to go too much farther because I would not give up that broader principle, but I do think families are important and to a lot of people, and understanding how and why and how to conduct those relationships as an objectivist, you know, I'd like to fit that in somehow.
I'd love to get.
David, let me just add quickly that the distinction Tom made between is it complete and is it integrated? And then the idea is, if you kick out any of the bricks in the integration, does it collapse? Things like not well developed, I agree with you on the family, that is an issue of incompleteness, right? And I have, unless I'm getting it wrong, I have interpreted most of what you've argued on open versus closed as the real issue is extension, in other words, the completeness part, not I have found some brick in the foundation which needs to be yanked out and the whole thing crumbles. And I agree with you. I don't think that's true when you go when you do reason, purpose, and self. I agree with you. I noticed the same thing in LSO. I thought that was a strengthening of the foundation, not a changing of it. But even your principle on benevolence, you're not saying, you know, we need to substitute benevolence and take out justice, you know, and put in benevolence. It was in addition to, right? And that is not challenging the structure of it, but extending it, making it more consistent. I feel the same way, that you're not rejecting the traitor principle. You're saying, hey, it also applies to family, or should. So
yeah,
that's just my 2 cents worth on them.
Okay, no, thank you.
Jason Hill in, I know he's thought a lot about this as well. It's great to see you, Jason. Did you have some reflections on what's just been shared?
I do, but I wanted to ask another question of Richard, which is a more academic question, since I'm an academic philosopher who's taught Ayn Rand for 25 years in the university.
Yeah.
So, Richard, I wanted to ask you this question. I've been teaching Rand since I was a graduate student, and much to the chagrin of my then 25 years ago, 30 years ago, superiors, and now as a full professor, I still teach her. And yeah. one of the as a scholar, of ideas, one of the annoyances I have with Rand is the ease with which she has dismissed philosophers and have quite often misinterpreted important figures in the history of philosophy. I mean, calling Immanuel Kant the most evil man in history or the most evil philosopher is seems quite ridiculous to me, for many reasons. It implies intentionality.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that Immanuel Kant intended to inflict evil on the world.
Yeah.
Her dismissal of her characterization of Plato, is who's one of the probably the greatest philosopher in the world, aside from Aristotle.
Yeah.
There's a toss up there is ludicrous.
Yeah.
And her refusal to also acknowledge the extent to which, and I think Ayn Rand is quite original, but that they're also, I mean, I've read the extant literature on Locke, on Mill, and much of what there are forerunners to the thoughts of Ayn Rand that existed in Locke, existed in John Stuart Mill, and she wasn't a scholar. She was, she was the creator of a philosophic system. But I wonder if you could say something about her reluctance to admit to the extent to which she need not have said that she was influenced by these people, but the extent to which remnants of her ideas were to have been found already existing in previous philosophers. I'm not sure that would have made a difference to how well she might have been accepted in the academy, because I think the academics were just out to get her from the get-go. But it might have made a difference to how other independent scholars might have taken her seriously. If you had thoughts on that.
I do have thoughts on that, because I've taught her as well and gotten reactions, good and bad, to her as well. I've noticed the same thing. I interpret it this way. First of all, the bulk of her early career was as a novelist, not as a philosopher. And she herself tells us that she, thought about and read about philosophy more later than earlier, versus the scholars we see today, Jason, that from, age 24, that's all they're doing. Point one. Point two, I think she was so original that her method was not, let me read a shelf full of books and then think what I think. And I think that meant that she wasn't always clear about, well, who said what before I said it. And it's over the top now, but that the standard view today is, you open up any academic book, I hate this, and on the acknowledgments page, there's, 75 people that are thanked for helping the author get this 200-page book done. Or the other thing they do is the literature review, right? You cannot get through grad school, you cannot get through any journal article without the literature review. And those who don't know what that means is you have to survey what everyone else ever said on the topic before you open your mouth and say your own thing. So she certainly did not do that. On the other hand, Peikoff and others have said they know what her library looked like and what she read. And the Marginalia book is very interesting because you see her reading Human Action and making margin comments and other things. She had the works of Aristotle in her library and stuff. But I agree with you. I think when you read, especially the introduction in The New Intellectual, that kind of survey, that kind of very superficial survey of the history of philosophy, I think the thumbnail sketches of things like logical positivism and other things are accurate. But to a scholarly ear, they're seen as very superficial and very juvenile. But I chalk up this somewhat to, yes, she wasn't a scholar and a teacher. She used to say, I'm not a very good teacher at all. And she used to say, Peikoff's a great teacher. So she's an originator, and I think just by the nature of it, the originators are not all that consumed with consuming everything said prior to them. And as a result, they're going to make some sweeping comments about, nobody has, really recognized X and such until I did. I think there is a bit of that in her. I will say something about, I know she's sometimes compared with Nietzsche. I want to say something about Nietzsche separately. Sometimes she's dismissed in academia, Jason. They'll say that she's being one a novelist and no rigorous, treatise on this or that. Although the introduction to objectivist epistemology is technical, I think, at the level we're talking about. But it's not an impediment to Nietzsche being taught. And Nietzsche himself is known as being an aphoristic philosopher, or writer. And there are Nietzsche courses all over the place in academia. So I will often bring up Nietzsche as an example of, well, if Nietzsche can be taught and he doesn't have rigorous, treatises on things, and she's better than that. She's got much more philosophy than he does. But I've noticed that. And if you're asking, do I think that's one of the reasons she's not accepted in academic philosophy? I think that is one of the reasons. And I'm not saying they're all honest when these people are rejecting her, but it's easy to go there and say, look how sloppy she is on, summarizing Kant or this or that. So I don't know if that helps.
It does. Thank you so much, Richard. Thank you.
David, did you want to share any reflections on that? Or otherwise I'll go to Roger. So good to see you.
Just a quick, I want to get to Roger, but I agree with the observations of both Jason and Richard, and from my time in academic life, I have seen the same thing. I just say that having lived in the academic world and being an intellectual for my entire working life, someone once said that, gave one of these, you know, people are either A or B, and which most of which are oversimplified. But someone once said that scholars are either fountainheads or cisterns. Fountainheads who create new knowledge and cisterns who collect knowledge.
Yeah.
And that always resonated with me. I think Ayn Rand was a fountainhead, not a cistern. They're both valuable, but if the cisterns are, you know, the multi-page literature reviews that I've seen always make me laugh because you know, most of that stuff is window dressing. Anyway, so that's all.
Let's move on. Remember, she also said, David, you know, many people just start their theories with, well, what did the last ethicists say? And I'll start from there. So that's like a glimpse of what she thought of, you know, how much do you really have to delve into the history? I've also, this might help, Jason, I've also said to people, students sometimes, I'll say, you know, she wasn't the first atheist, and she wasn't the first one to try to defend reason. There's Aristotle, right? Or individualism, or rights, or free markets, or even romantic art. But, you know, you can get an atheist who ends up being a Marxist, right? And you can get someone for reason and they don't quite get induction correctly. I think what's unique about her is she's got all these things in one system fully integrated and mutually reinforcing. That's rare. That's not been done. But but when they pick her off by saying, hey, she's not the first one to come up with this, that's true. And she's not the first one to defend individualism. That's true. But when you put the whole thing together and tell these people, well, yeah, but she has the whole package and saw it all together. What do you think of that? That's sometimes an approach I take.
All right. Roger, so good to see you, my friend. Been a while.
Likewise. I hope you guys enjoyed it, Freedom Fest. And I see that the Yale Revolution Conference is next for y'all, so I hope you have fun there too.
Will you be there?
I might, my travel schedule has been impeded by family life, so I may not be able to. But I do have a question for Richard here, and I'll backchat you on the travel stuff. But Richard, what do you think the best way to introduce people to Rand is? I've experimented with here, start with a small novel, and you know, I'll give them a copy of Anthem, and see if they could start with something small to chew on. Then I've experimented with not giving a novel at all, and you know, moving right into philosophy. And I don't know if I've figured out the best way. In conversation, it works better where, you know, I've run into people that are critical of Rand. That don't even really, they acknowledge that they've never really read any of her work, but they're critical because of what they've heard of her, which is always a big red flag when anybody does that. And so my opening when I'm talking to people is I tell people, well, do you believe that happiness is important? And then if they acknowledge that, because you have to be very narcissistic to not think that happiness is an important thing. And then I talk about the emphasis she places on happiness, and I explain that no place other than Aristotle can you go to really learn the importance of why being happy is such an important virtue. But I'm curious from your perspective, if you're taking somebody, maybe not critical, because I don't know if I have the patience to bring critics into the fold, but for people that are open-minded, what would be where would you point them to? To get their, to get them interested in Rand in the beginning.
Richard?
Can you hear me?
My criteria has been look at the age, the intelligence, and the interests of the person who's asking or you're thinking of approaching. So a 17-year-old who's like adult and not very intelligent is different than, say, a 25-year-old who's intelligent. And suppose their interest is capitalism. She has such a body of work that it's pretty easy quickly to gauge the interests of the person you're talking about. I would never start with just like one book and say, whoever they are at whatever age, whatever intelligence, you know, read Anthem. I would gauge, as I said, their age, their intelligence, and their interest and go from there. And there's a number of books and stuff you could give them. Now, if they do the critical thing, the way I handle the critical thing is they'll say something like, well, what have you heard? And they might say something like, well, she thought you could do whatever you want. And then you would say, well, you really need to read The Virtue of Selfishness, because there she argues that it's rational egoism, not hedonism, say. Or if they heard that, well, no, she's an anarchist who believes in laissez-faire, then you'd point them to Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. So my method is not to start with a book that I have in mind that these people must read, but it doesn't take long to gauge their age, their intelligence, and their interest. And then it's our job to just name one thing they should start with. That's how I would do it. And of course, the obvious one is if they're interested in a good story, you go with the novels. So that's been my approach. It's worked over the years. My weakness is I tend not to approach people and proselytize. I kind of wait for them to come to me and ask, and then I guide them. So I think that's the best way to do it, Roger. Start with their values.
I love it. Thank you.
You're welcome, Roger. Thank you.
Scott, you've been awfully quiet. I'm sure you're taking it all in. I don't know if you have any reflections or a question for Richard.
Yeah, I mean, great topic. Some of the stuff was touched on even by Tom a little bit. Just somewhat along those lines, I just, you know, what you were just saying, when bringing people in, let's say they're, you know, religious, I mean, do you just try to, you know, start with the idea of just something you can agree on, like economics? Or do you think it's important to say, oh, you know, you have to disregard your religious beliefs to be an objectivist?
No, that's a good one. That's a good one, Scott. And you know, by tabling by now, these are the questions we get when the students come by or anybody comes by at these conferences. No, on something like religion, I look for a bridge. So I'll say, someone will say something like, the student will come up and they'll say, I really love Ayn Rand. I've heard some great stuff about her. I'm a capitalist. I love America, Constitution, but I'm religious. And how do I take this? My approach has been something like, you know, Ayn Rand thought religion was important, which is a very generic answer. And they would look at me like, what? And I would say, you know, she called it a primitive form of philosophy. And she was a big advocate of having a philosophy of life. And she says, religion does offer a kind of view of existence and a code of values and sometimes even political advice, but she thought it should be enlightened philosophy. And that's the problem. We shouldn't be living in a modern world relying on a medieval approach to ethics. So it's a way to bridge it. And instead of being what she called a militant atheist, you go with the reason this person might be religious and yet also be edging toward Ayn Rand. So the bridge there to me is we're both apparently philosophical to some extent. Now let's see if we can get a rational scientific ethic and rejecting these ideas that without God, you know, anything goes. So that would be an approach in religion. No, I wouldn't bring up economics when it comes to religion. I would go straight, if that was their objection or if that was their uncomfortableness, I would go right at that, but not in an antagonistic way. There's plenty of stuff she has said about religion, which is very interesting and not that combative. So that's a way to bridge it.
Great stuff. Thank you.
Welcome.
All right. Well, we've got about 6 more minutes. So if there's anybody in the audience that has been lurking and would like to ask a question, now is the time. Raise your hand and we will bring you up on stage.
Well, yeah, we especially welcome those who are lurking like that.
Great. Otherwise, I'll grab another question from our Instagram pantry, and one of those, Richard, was asking whether or not Ayn Rand was more similar in terms of her beliefs to classical liberalism or libertarianism.
Ah, that's a good question. Libertarianism is, I think, a more recent term. And classical liberalism, with retrospect, was usually assigned to those in the 17th and 18th century. And the distinction there was liberals took the word liberalism, I don't know, starting, I think, in the early 20th century. So looking in retrospect, people had to go back and say, no, I mean classical liberal, not liberal in the sense of statist today. But I would put it this way, to the extent, and this is disputable, but to the extent libertarianism today is associated, and by today I mean the last 50 years or so, is associated with subjectivism and eclecticism, namely, you know, any foundations will do, any kind of ethic will do as long as you're for liberty, but then also an anarchy. On all those levels, she was a big critic. So, and of course, she went out of her way to say, I'm not a libertarian. I don't know whether she's ever actually used the word classical liberal or was asked that way. But when I think of the Enlightenment thinkers, the founding fathers, or people like John Locke or Bacon or Newton, if you said to her, isn't that you? Or, and of course, they were constitutionalists, right? They weren't anarchists, although some of them were anarchists. But the founding fathers were definitely of the view that government should be constitutionally limited to protecting individual rights. I think for all those reasons, including, by the way, Adam Smith and others' tentative early defenses of self-interest, weak, sometimes weak and inconsistent defenses, but the fact that Smith and others were even attempting to defend self-interest, and of course the founders capturing it in The Pursuit of Happiness, I think for all those reasons, she is not just much closer, but she's classical liberal in the way, and definitely not a libertarian. It's weird today because libertarians will say we are the modern day classical liberals, but they're really not in the sense that they embrace subjectivism, eclecticism, and anarchism. My experience, by the way, has been those libertarians who do care more about the objectivity of underlying pillars and believe in constitutionally limited government are friendlier to Ayn Rand. There is a pattern there. Oh, that was a question from Instagram.
Yeah. John, we've got 2 minutes, so hit it.
Thank you. I'm just wondering if we could have commentary on natural law and the interface or the interaction between the science of human nature and the philosophy of objectivism.
Well, I think, John, natural law, unfortunately, has been associated with supernatural law. So the natural law theorists of the Enlightenment period were saying that basically God endowed, the founders had some of this, that God endowed us with certain things, including rights. And the and Ayn Rand's view, of course, is there's one, there's no God endowing. On the other hand, the importance of starting with what we know, namely human nature. And what is human nature? And that ethics should be based on that, on the actual requirements of human life. That is the true natural, because she's not invoking any kind of supernatural explanation. So I don't think we have time for a much bigger answer than that. But beware of this phrase natural law, because to an objective,
yes,
it sounds
my question was really bias more toward the scientific side of it, and the interaction of science and philosophy, and how objectivism integrates with the science of human nature.
Yeah, I would just say briefly that Ayn Rand believed that ethics could be scientific, but it had to be by basing it on human nature, and that the essence of human nature was the rational faculty, as Aristotle pointed out. So, I think all that's right. Over. Oh, thank you, John.
Thank you. This was a great topic. Just wanted to touch briefly. We've got more great events going on Next week, we're going to be having our happy hour Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern on Clubhouse on whether Ayn Rand is the best answer to woke. Then at 7 p.m. that night, we'll be having Rob Trzynski on Clubhouse, The Lessons of Sri Lanka. And then Wednesday of next week, the Atlas Society asks Jeremy Adams at 5 p.m. Eastern. That should be good. And then we've got Richard Salzman back here on Thursday with an Ask Me Anything just generally. That's great that you're willing to do that. And so lots of good activities, and we look forward to seeing you for those.
Thanks, Scott. And thank you, Richard. Thank you, David. Thank you, Jason. Roger, also great to see you. John Clark, this was fantastic. And I will see you guys next week.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you all.